In the 10th century, the 4th century of the Islamic calendar, Baghdad was the place to be. It was capital of the mighty Abbasid Empire and had a larger population than any medieval European city. Its magnetic pull drew intellectuals from across the Islamic Empire, not just Muslims, but also Christians and Jews. Like 17th century Paris, Baghdad had a thriving salon culture, where these intellectuals could meet to argue, to display their expertise in poetry, in the Arabic language, or indeed in philosophy. In such a setting, or over dinner at the house of a patron, a man of culture might display his learning by quoting Plato or alluding casually to the doctrines of Aristotle. An elegant country outing might feature desultory conversation about the early Greek thinker Empedocles. Philosophy was one thread in the colorful tapestry of Abbasid society, a thread which had wound its way into the Muslim world from the Greeks. This was thanks to a vigorous translation movement that had gone on for more than a century, producing Arabic versions of everything from the Elements of Euclid to the medical works of Galen, and a remarkably complete collection of treatises by Aristotle. The very Arabic word for philosophy, falsafa, marked the Hellenic origins of the discipline, since this was just a version of the Greek term philosophia. Not everyone was a fan. Some felt that this importation of Hellenic culture was superfluous at best, harmful at worst. Certainly no substitution for careful study of the Quran and the Arabic language itself. Philosophy was foreign, it was pretentious, and it was strongly linked to the Christians, who had done most of the work in translating this Greek stuff into Arabic in the first place. This was the view of a man named Sirafi, an expert in grammar who came up against a Christian logician in a debate at one of the courtly talking shops of the day. The Christian, by the name of Abu Bishr Mata, set out his stall in the debate by announcing that Aristotle's logic is the indispensable tool to know true from false, to tell good from bad. Sirafi scoffed at this and, according to a later recounting of their debate, proceeded to wipe the floor with his Christian adversary. Logic may help you tell true from false and good from bad, but it won't necessarily help you win a public debate. Philosophy did not prevail on that occasion, but it wasn't going to be banished from Muslim society as Sirafi hoped. This was thanks in no small part to Mata himself and the group he founded, the so-called Baghdad School. When it came to Greek ideas, these were the professionals. They didn't just quote Aristotle in polite society, they finished the process of translating him and then wrote commentaries on the new Arabic versions of his works. Most of them were Christians, like Mata, with one important exception, Al-Farabi. When the later and even greater philosopher Avicenna looked back at this group, he singled out Farabi for praise, while heaping scorn on the achievements of Farabi's Christian colleagues, not necessarily because they were Christians, but just because he was unimpressed by their facility with logic and other parts of Aristotle's philosophy. As for Farabi, he was also enthusiastically received in Muslim Spain. The great Jewish philosopher of Andalusia, Maimonides, recommended Farabi's works to his students as fine flour. Also in Spain, Farabi deeply influenced the greatest of all Muslim Aristotelians, the commentator Averroes. The commentaries of Averroes would in turn be cherished by medieval Christians like Thomas Aquinas, and in those commentaries he was reviving the professionalized philosophical project of the Baghdad School. So who was this man Farabi? Unfortunately, we don't know much about his life. His name means he came from one of two locations in Central Asia, either Farab or Faryab. He studied and taught amongst the Christians of the Baghdad school, and later went to Syria and Egypt, dying in the middle of the 10th century in Damascus. His writings reflect the agenda of the Baghdad school. He wrote commentaries on Aristotle, concentrating on the logical works so prized by the school founder Mata. But Farabi seems to have had a more ambitious aim than his colleagues did. He wanted not just to elucidate Aristotle, or to press philosophical ideas into the service of religion. Rather, he sought to integrate all branches of philosophy into a single systematic theory. This theory would explain God and the place of humankind in the cosmos God has created. It would explain the nature of knowledge, and the special sort of knowledge enjoyed in prophetic revelation. It would explain the ideal political arrangements made possible by this sort of prophecy. And, of course, it would do all of that upon the firm foundations of Aristotle's logic. Whatever you make of Farabi's ideas, you can't fault him for lack of ambition. At the core of Farabi's systematic vision of, well, everything, is a parallel between the universe and the ideal political community. Both have a single ruler. In the case of the universe, that ruler is, of course, God. Following ancient consensus, Farabi understands the universe to consist of nested, transparent spheres, gliding in eternal, circular motions around the Earth at their center. Imagine a globe made of glass balls, one placed inside another without any gaps in between. Embedded in these spheres are visible stars and planets, which enable us to study the motions of the spheres every night as they revolve above us. Farabi again follows Aristotle in thinking that there are immaterial intellects, you can think of them as angels if you want, that are responsible for the celestial motions. Orchestrating the whole system is God, who created it in the first place, albeit that this is an eternal sort of creation, not one that took place at some first moment in time. Here, Farabi differs from the opinion of the most important Muslim philosopher before him, Al-Kindi. Kindi had argued strenuously that the world cannot be both created and eternal. Kindi's anti-eternity view will be the mainstream one among philosophers, with only hardcore Aristotelians like Farabi, Avicenna, and Averroes insisting on an eternal universe. For Farabi, the most crucial element in the celestial system, apart from God himself, is the lowest of the heavenly intellects or angels. It has a number of jobs to perform in Farabi's philosophy. For one thing, it ensures the production of plants, animals, and humans here on Earth. For another, it plays a role in human knowledge. Just as we could not see without the presence of light, so we could not think without the presence of this intellect. And, just as some people see more keenly than others, some people are more successful than others when it comes to thinking. Farabi believes that a perfect philosopher would be one who comes to understand everything that the heavenly intellect understands. He isn't so immodest as to claim that he has attained this lofty level of insight himself, but he does insist that it is possible, at least in principle. In fact, it seems pretty clear that for Farabi, such people have actually existed. For it is this sort of understanding that would be possessed by a prophet. Of course, he is thinking first and foremost of the Prophet Muhammad, and of the other true prophets recognized in Islam, from the first man Adam down to Jesus. Muslims accept that Jesus was a prophet, but of course deny that he was the incarnation of God. Still, Farabi never explicitly says any of this. He rather self-consciously describes the prophet in the abstract, without naming Muhammad or any other prophetic figure. He describes the prophet as someone who has the complete understanding of the perfect philosopher and also the ability to guide a community of fellow humans. Thus, the ideal ruler is in fact both a philosopher and a prophet. If you remember your Plato, you may realize that the notion of a philosopher king isn't original with Farabi. And indeed, Farabi does here seem to be drawing on information about Plato's Republic, even though there was apparently no full Arabic translation of that dialogue. So, what does the prophet have that the perfect philosopher doesn't have? And how is it that he can rule a community so effectively? The answer is that, with the help of the friendly celestial intellect, or angel, the prophet can devise powerful symbols and images that can convey his insights to the common folk. Your everyday citizens are not going to be able to follow philosophical demonstrations. So, if such people are going to be persuaded to believe and act in the right way, the prophet must appeal to them in a more vivid and concrete way. Instead of proving that there is a first mover of an eternal universe using arguments found in Aristotle, the prophet may describe God as a king sitting upon a throne. Instead of explaining the principles of ethics, the prophet may unleash terrifying descriptions of punishments in the next world to frighten the citizens into behaving themselves. This sort of symbolic representation of the truth is what Farabi understands by religion. This may sound like a remarkably rationalist or even disdainful understanding of religion and prophecy. Is religion really just philosophy for dummies? Well, no. For Farabi, prophecy is not just a matter of dressing up scientific truth in colorful language. Rather, Each prophet is tailoring the truth to the people he leads, which is why every nation gets its own prophet, its own revelation. The prophet's understanding of how universal truth relates to concrete particular situations also enables him to make the right decisions for his community on a daily basis. This is something that would be impossible for a philosopher who has universal scientific understanding, but not the ability to apply it to individual cases. So pivotal is the prophet-philosopher-ruler for the health of his society that great efforts must be made to carry on his teachings once he is gone. An entire discipline of religious law must try to discover how the prophet's original rulings might be applied to new situations that did not arise in his lifetime. As this allusion to the religious law shows, Farabi is thinking all the while of the Islamic community, even if he does not speak its name. His whole philosophy can in fact be seen as an attempt to draw together the resources of the Greek tradition into a system that can make sense of the Islamic faith. In that respect, Farabi was like Kindi before him, Avicenna after him, and any number of other Muslim thinkers in the Golden Age and beyond. As late as the 16th century, in the Persian Safavid Empire, figures like Mullah Sadra will still be exploring the resonances between their religion and the Greek texts they could read in the Arabic translations that had been produced in the age of Kindi and Farabi. Farabi and his Baghdad colleagues helped to launch this sustained engagement with Aristotle and other Greek thinkers, but they never simply repeated the ideas of the Greeks. Against philosophy's critics, they showed how these foreign, pagan ideas could be reworked into a philosophy fit for the Abrahamic faiths. It was a philosophy that transcended religious boundaries, and was thus appropriate for the place that produced it, Baghdad, the most cosmopolitan city of the religious and ethnic empire overseen by the Abbasids.